Hello and welcome to another episode of the Scottish Housing News Podcast. I'm Kieran Fidley, the editor of Scottish Housing News, and with me in the studio, as always, is my co-host, Jimmy Black. When selecting topics for discussion on this podcast, Jimmy and I will usually lean towards issues that we think are the most pressing for the housing sector, but quite often something happens that isn't the most urgent of subjects that will capture the imagination. And it's fair to say that today's topic is one that fascinated yourself, Jimmy.
It is, because looking at the press releases coming in about the regeneration of the Dalmarnock area and the Clyde Gateway, I was reminded of where I worked in something like 1978 in a Christmas card factory in the summer, DJ Clark's Christmas card factory in Cotton Road. And it was a friendly place. People, the guys welcomed me, the student from the university who was humping Christmas cards around the factory, and it was a very rundown area. I was cycling there, the factory was ancient, everything just seemed to be crumbling, the tenements around were, you know, half derelict and a lot of them had been demolished. So I'm just fascinated to see what's happening.
So to help us explore this past, the present and the future of Dalmarnock and the wider Clyde Gateway area, we have two people representing Clyde Gateway, the Urban Regeneration Organisation, which is leading much of the transformation of the area. We have Martin Mackay, who until recently was the Executive Director of Regeneration at Clyde Gateway, but has since stepped up to the role of Chief Executive Designate ahead of taking on the full role in a few months' time. And also Rosie Robertson, she is the Glasgow Area Local Community Representative on the Regeneration Board at Clyde Gateway, and a long time resident of Dalmarnock. So, Rosie, could you tell us a bit about, could you tell us a bit about the bustling, busy Dalmarnock of the past, the industries, the life of the people, what it was like growing up there?
Sure. Jimmy, I'm just thinking of you saying you worked there in 1978. I was born there in 76, so you might have passed me trying to toddle along Sunnybank Street or Allen Street. But I grew up in the tenements there. Originally on Sunnybank Street, where we didn't have an inside toilet, so we were a family of four in a kind of single end type property. And then as a toddler, we were lucky enough to move around the corner to Allen Street in the tenements, and we had an indoor toilet, which actually had been installed by a resident. So for us, that was absolute luxury. And Dalmarnock was a great place. The school was up the road, my auntie was round the corner, you know, I had loads of family around, and it was a real strong knit community. And like many communities in Glasgow at the time, you know, although we lived in sort of relative poverty, I don't think we knew we were poor until we were much older, and you could sort of compare it to other places. So it was I've got real strong, great memories of growing up in Dalmarnock and the people and the families that lived there. But it was in decline. There were not a lot of opportunities locally, and you had all the usual problems with, you know, crime and gang fighting and all that sort of stuff, which definitely has an impact on you growing up and seeing that. And also there was an understanding that people like us that lived in these areas only moved into certain types of jobs, only lived in certain types of houses. You know, that was just the understanding. And there was a real strong pride of being working class in Dalmarnock. And I think that's still very much there, you know. So I just remember a Dalmarnock where you had factories at the Clyde. It took me a long time to know we lived next to the Clyde, by the way. I was in primary school and our school backed onto the Clyde, but it was kind of cut off with fencing, so you never ever saw it. And it wasn't until I got a bit older and started sneaking over this green space known as the Coupe behind the power station that actually we discovered the Clyde. And for me, that's one of the biggest transformations now, because you've got housing overlooking the Clyde. You can't miss the Clyde. You've got cunning a loop where you're invited to enjoy the Clyde as part of your daily walk. It's just totally transformed. But going back to then, I mean, I have just warm, strong, beautiful memories of Dalmarnock.
Martin, what happened then? Why did the area go into decline from this bustling hub of industry?
Yeah, it's amazing. I think I was showing a photograph of Dalmarnock the other day there, and you see the tenements right next to the factories, right next to the gas works. close to the power station, the train station there, and you can see the trams. And you know, there's probably not one bit of greenery in that particular photograph, but it was the sort of sustainable neighbourhood that we now probably want, and that people could live and work. You know, you can walk out the front door, you're a tenement, walk down the street, and go and work in a factory or somewhere else. But what changed in the East End of Glasgow was very similar to other centres in the UK, in that Dumarnock has suffered at least about 50 years of decline. A lot of that was a change in terms of post-war and the broader economy within the city. The kind of industries that were moving out were the, you know, things like the gas works, the power station, the chemical works. But these were industries that employed lots and lots of people. So they were moving out. The industries that were left were kind of industries that were in decline, industries that were being shipped off to other locations. So that was having a factor as well. And then there was a broader housing stock within the area, which was declining as well in terms of its quality and its standard, and all of these things. And at that time, you then had the kind of perfect storm within Glasgow, a city in decline, and then alongside that, you know, the tenement clearances elsewhere in the cities, the new towns being constructed. So then people started to move out of the area as well, and then would move to new towns or to other locations. So you had the core industries leaving, you had the businesses in decline, and you had the people leaving. And what we talk about at Clyde Gateway is people, place and jobs. And so what Dumarnock and Lymer, lots of places in the UK at that time, started to lose all of that. And what was left was some areas that were, you know, great areas, still functioning well, but others that had just been left behind and with no real thought given to what comes afterwards.
What kind of effect does it have on people to live in an area which is in that kind of decline, Rosie?
God, okay. Well, I really believe that where you live, the physical environment and the opportunities that presents have a massive impact on your mental and your physical health and the things you get to do in life. And if you live in, you know, I always liken it to when I go on holiday, if I'm somewhere nice in Spain and you're walking down a street and the paving's beautiful and it's tree lined and the sun's beating down, we can't always control that, but you know, it just feels nice, you feel part of something nice, and you kind of might internalise that a wee bit and feel quite good about yourself being in that space. But if you're growing up in a place where, you know, it is in decline, it is run down, it's not being invested in, and that the opportunities are limited, then you might also internalise that. And what it does is limit you, maybe make you feel less valuable. The reputation of an area, again, you can internalise that. You know, the external perceptions of an area, you know, oh, Dumarnock, that's rough, oh, you know, people don't work there, or there's problems with crime there, and they associate that with you the minute that you say you're from there. And so you start to feel a sense of shame. You might get anger and get a wee bit indignant as well, but you might feel a sense of shame, and then you might limit your own aspirations or the aspirations of your children. So for me, it's so important that we live in areas that make us feel good about ourselves. I want to walk down a street in Dumarnock and feel as good as I would anywhere else in the world. And I think that everybody that lives there now is entitled to that. Good paving, good buildings, good lighting, good transport links, good amenities, facilities for everybody, access to jobs, all of the things that every community should have. And if you don't have that, then you can feel really bad about yourself, and it can be life-limiting.
Now, I would imagine that perception that people have of themselves presumably is shared by people outside the area, and that would limit the investment, the desire, the appetite to invest in that area. So how do you take a community, Martin, and turn it around and deal with the thing that's stopping people from investing and creating jobs and creating facilities?
I was once asked at the start of Clyde Gateway if I could change one thing, what would it be? And I said perception, because that was the thing that was holding a lot of the area back. What we've tried to do at Clyde Gateway, I guess, is get people engaged into a shared vision and a shared objectives. You know, now, to kind of give it a Sunday name, we talk about sustainable place, transformation, We talk about increasing economic activity, and we talk about increasing community capacity. But now, you know, kind of people, place, and jobs is how we summarise that. And what you've kind of got to do in the early days of regeneration is bring the pride back, deal with some of the things that Rosie speaks about in terms of the, you know, the derelict buildings, some of the things that were really giving people a bad perception of the area that was in many occasions just unwarranted. So one of the projects that we worked on very initially in Clyde Gateway was the redevelopment of Bridson Cross and the Olympia building, really at the heart of the community. And we developed out the Olympia building as a mixed-use facility with a new library onto a new invigorated Bridston Cross and a painted umbrella at that point, you know, and that just kind of set a marker down that we were here and that we were serious, because this was a community that had went through regeneration before with the Gear project. So what we had to do was come in and be different. And what we've done as a regeneration company, and we learned lessons from other areas as well, of course, is it's not just about physical regeneration. So it's about working with communities. It's about having them direct the things that they want to happen in their community. It's about engaging people within that process as well. And, you know, it's been long-term decline. So if you're going to turn around long-term decline, then you need long-term engagement. And you're only going to be able to do that if you've got the support of the local community. So once you've kind of, you've got through that kind of process, and that's one that will carry on throughout our lifespan, then you can go and tell the story to other people, you know, and break down that perception and break down that barrier, which we've managed to do pretty successfully in a number of areas.
So to tell the story, you need the community. You need the community on board. You can create a master plan. You can tell everybody how you're going to transform this area. But Rosie, did you feel involved, and did the local people feel involved in the decision making about their homes in the community?
You know, yes, because prior to this, Glasgow City Council were doing a thing with Sir Harry Burns, and it was all about working out what are the social determinants of health. And when they came to us with that, we were like, what do you mean? Don't know what you're talking about. And basically they had some city council planners who wanted to test out planning in a different way. And that led to a project called Equally Well, which there were about 8 test sites across Scotland at the time, and Glasgow was one of them. And really they were looking at parts of South Dunmarnock and coming up with maps and plans and saying, how do we take these maps and plans to the community and get their feedback? And we said, well, first of all, you get rid of the maps because they don't understand them. You get rid of the jargon because they don't understand them. You know, they don't know your planning terminology and speak, and they don't have to have a conversation about how a place makes them feel and how it enhances their life. And so as a community, at the time I worked in a place called Bridgeton Community Learning Campus, we got to explore with an literacy project, how do you have these conversations? And what we ended up doing was coming up with daily journeys that people took throughout their communities and recorded using different means that suited them. So some people used dictaphones, some people took photographs, and we came up with these stories and scrapbooks that explained to anybody that was interested what it was like to live in that community and what was the challenges that people faced in terms of the physical environment around them. And that was eye-opening for us as a community, because we were able to have that conversation with people that had a responsibility towards making some changes, and also gave planners almost a document that they could interpret then into the language that they needed to use to write planning policy. And that was a fantastic experience, and it was on the back of that Clyde Gateway came along, and I was introduced through that process. So at that point we were just starting to explore how to have these conversations and understanding the link between where we live and how we live and on our health. So that was fantastic. And then, you know, I remember hearing Ian Manson, the current chief exec that Martin's going to be taking over from, and he was given a bit of an introduction to Clyde Gateway, and I went along quite cynically, to be honest, thinking, you know, I'd heard all about Gear, and it, you know, for me it wasn't the most successful thing that had ever happened to Dunmarnock. What's this all about? You know, just really cynical. But I heard him speak, and through everything he said, he spoke about the people that live there and making a difference to their lives. and I kind of found myself believing him. And I've continued believing in him in the lifespan of Clyde Gateway to the point that I joined the board to try and make some kind of contribution. And Clyde Gateway have kept that up. It's the relationships with local people. It's listening to what will make a difference to them and what do they actually need, rather than saying, I'm the expert, I'm the planner, I know what's going to make a difference to you, and I'm going to come in and impose all my thoughts and ideas, and maybe you'll benefit, maybe you won't. It's all well-intentioned. But I believe Clyde Gateway has flipped that around and actually said, no, we want to help you get jobs, we want to help you get access to education and training. We want to start from the ground up, from your children and the nurseries and the schools, all the way up through the ages. And we want to make this a better place to live. And, you know, I believe Clyde Gateway has operated that way from the beginning. That and the fact that it's a 20-year-long project with long-term investment from its partners has made the absolute difference in terms of that and how it stands against other regeneration projects.
So, Martin, important question. Where does Clyde Gateway get the money from to transform Dalmarnock and surrounding areas?
Well, Clyde Gateway is a partnership, and that's really critical for regeneration. So we're a partnership between Glasgow City Council, South Lanarkshire Council and Scottish Enterprise, all of whom contribute to the work that we are doing here. And we are funded and supported by the Scottish Government as well. So that's the kind of underlying basis for how we are funded. But that is an increasingly smaller part of how we operate, because what we're able to do is operate commercially as well. So we invest in the property that makes a difference to the community, and then we're able to realise returns from that investment and then reinvest it back into the community as well. So that cuts across everything in terms of the property that we do. We build workplaces like industrial units, we invest into offices as well, you know, with some great new businesses coming into the area off the back of those. And of course, land for housing development, where we've, through the place development process, through master planning and others, we've been able to identify areas for new housing development, and we've been able to realise returns from that type of investment as well. So we have one foot in the public sector and one foot in the private sector.
There are housing associations working in the area. There's Link, West of Scotland and Thenew. There's private developers, Keepmoat, Springfield and Spectrum Properties. A lot of work has been done, a lot of work is still to do, but somebody had to be first. Martin, how did you sell Dalmarnock to investors, to developers, when it could be a while, like your 20-year master plan, it could be a while before the thing is complete and all these things start to kind of join together?
Yeah, well, I guess we benefited from two things. We benefited from the 2014 Commonwealth Games, and we benefited from the M74. That may be a very different conversation if you were talking about regeneration now in terms of roads-based investment. But, you know, the East End was an area that suffered in terms of its accessibility, and it needed that type of investment to open it back up. So we had the big event of the 2014 Games, and we had the big investment coming in off the back of the infrastructure that was related to that. And what the Commonwealth Games gave us was the Athletes Village, and that was 700 homes in 700 days, housing for sale, housing for social rent, that was used by the athletes during the Games, and then was converted back to use for housing after the Games. That was delivered by our partners at Glasgow City Council, so it was a huge gift to us in terms of what could be achieved within the area. And then we were able to work off the back of that in terms of the investment that we were making in the Cunningham Loop, the new bridges and key routes and spaces and all of that sat within that. So what the Commonwealth Games did was really help tackle that perception point that I spoke about earlier on, and it helped kind of change people's thinking about the area. And the Athletes Village is, you know, an absolutely fantastic example of housing-led regeneration, you know, really high quality housing right on the banks of the Clyde. So once that had been established, then what we were able to do alongside that was then work on the broader development master plan for Dalmarnock. And we've always been marketing industry led, so we've done a lot of engagement with the industry through that process. We've done a lot of engagement with the local community, and we were able to identify key sites for housing. And then over the years, we've then been able to progressively either release some of those sites for housing development or encourage others to come into the area and invest. And the housing market has been changing. So then we started to release housing for development. So the housing market really since 2008 has changed, remarkably over that period up until now. So we've had to be adaptable to the types of housing that's available in the area and the types of developers that we might work with to achieve that.
But Commonwealth Games you mentioned, and they've left you an amazing legacy of sports facilities that are of international quality. But two questions. One is, are local people in Dalmarnock and the rest of the surrounding areas actually financially, economically able to use those facilities? And the other thing is, did that development sweep away some traditional shops, for example, which have not been replaced and which maybe local people still need? Rosie, would you like to come in on that?
First of all, the first question about sporting facilities, I know that there has been a concerted effort from the likes of Glasgow Life to create programmes that help organise or local people to access those. Do I think that local people are using the velodrome? Absolutely not. But are they maybe using the spa facilities or the gym facilities? I would say yes, with support through different membership schemes and that kind of thing. And a lot of engagement with schools and that sort. So less concerned about that, great facilities to have on site. The biggest concern for local people and myself has been, before the Commonwealth Games, there were rows of shops underneath tenements where local people not only had access to groceries, but also meeting places, post office, a wee chippy on a Friday night, the kinds of things that you want to be able to have in your community. And the biggest thing that changed after the Commonwealth Games was the shops were gone. There was a lovely legacy in that they built a beautiful state-of-the-art community facility, and that's fantastic. But the issue of the shop has been lingering ever since, and that's something that's a real bugbear for local people. And you do have shops available to you within maybe a half-hour walk, some maybe a wee bit closer, like the Tesco. But if you have mobility issues or you have several young kids, then that doesn't make it as accessible as it might seem if you are mobile or, you have access to transport. So that's been a wee bit disappointing. And I think it's something that we can still address. We're looking at getting, Lidl's going to be on site, which is fantastic. That's what people need, somewhere to just go and get a pint of milk without taking an hour out of your day. But I believe that's just the start. Once you get Lidl in, you've got all these beautiful new homes in the area, that'll then, like other, it's prove successful in other areas, as it'll attract other folk to invest in the area as well. You're more likely to want to run a grocery shop in a place that's well populated, well looked after, has the right infrastructure. So I remain optimistic and hopeful that that's still something that we can improve on.
So there are still things to be done. There are some really innovative projects that you're working on around energy use, local heat networks serving industry and housing too. Can you tell us a bit more about that, Martin?
Yeah, happy to. I mean, just picking up on kind of Rosie's point, people drive services, so if we get more housing into the area, get more people into the area, then we can really start to kind of build off the back of that as well. So I'm kind of really hopeful that we'll start to see some of those other uses start to wrap around what we're doing here. In terms of energy, yeah, really exciting. We've been involved in energy and carbon master planning right from the outset, so we anticipated that, the amount of development that would be needed in the East End would require us to consider about how we delivered energy and energy uses. So we've been advocates of district heating systems, and we are currently developing two. The first one of those is already live. It's a partnership with Scottish Water Horizons. So they own and operate the energy centre, and Clyde Gateway owns and operates the heat network. And that will deliver heat in the form of hot water to homes and to businesses. And for a you know, for a housing development, what it means is people have a heat interface unit where they would normally have a boiler, and that heat interface unit then helps distribute the hot water to the radiators and to the taps in the house. So it's a really exciting way in terms of us being able to generate heat and deliver it to homes, and alongside that, businesses as well. So our Eastworks development will be one of the first developments that's connected into that system. So that was over £6 million of investment into that heat network. We were very fortunate to get investment from SP Energy Networks into that as well. And yeah, that system is now live. And so later on this year, you'll be able to come along and see Eastworks connected to that system. You'll be able to go and see Keepmoat Homes, one of the first private sector developers connected into that system. And then alongside that, we're working on a project which is called D2 Grids. It's a European pilot project, or one of five European locations. And we're delivering on that network what's called an ambient loop. So a lower temperature system, which when it delivers lower temperature water into a building, then within the building you use a heat pump either to boost the temperature up and heat the building, or reverse it, cool it down and to cool the building. And we are taking the heat source for that directly from the wastewater treatment works. So we have an extraction system within the wastewater treatment works that helps us then pass it to a heat exchanger and then pass it into the ambient loop. Alongside that, we then have lots of solar panels, lots of battery storage, and we then feed electricity back into the electricity grid at the same time to help offset the running of the heat pumps. So we are a green regeneration innovation district, and you'll be able to come here and see a heat network operating, you'll be able to see one under construction, and you'll be able to see the next phase of research into those types of networks.
Fantastic.
Rosie, when you're ideally regenerating an area, you will have a mix of tenures, and as we've mentioned so far, there's social homes, there's homes for private sale. What's your thoughts on the current balance that's there in Dalmarnock?
I was really pleased, going back to Commonwealth Games, that it was being mixed and that there was homes for everybody, because typically you have your better off areas and then you have your poorer areas, and people stay within those and mix with people from those, and it's just not diverse at all. So for me, it's really important that people come together, encourage each other, motivate each other, learn from each other, and build relationships regardless of what type of housing you come from. And it gets away from that stigma of social housing, because if you look at Dalmarnock just now, you really can't tell if it's privately owned or if it's social housing. The housing is stunning. It's real high quality. It's beautiful to live in. So for me, it's vital. And, we need to be careful that it's not a case that, we'll put the privately owned houses on this side of the street and we'll put the social housing on this side of the street and we'll put a wee kind of natural barrier between the two, because you're still separating them, whether it's nice trees or not. So you really do need to get that mix in there. And I feel that that's been achieved in Dalmarnock.
And what else has been achieved in terms of the well-being of Dalmarnock and its residents?
Well, it's a bit like, I remember seeing, so I'm an ex-smoker, and I remember being in the West End, and I was walking along the street quite gingerly, having a cigarette. And when I was finished, I went to flick it on the ground, as I would do in Dalmarnock. I would just have done that without thinking. But because I was in a slightly nicer area, I thought, I better not do that. People will judge me. And I looked for an ashtray to put it out. I wanted to take care of the place I was in because it was being took care of. Whereas at home, nobody would have blinked an eye at me flicking that cigarette in the ground. So I suppose for me, it's, behaviours change. If other people are investing in your community and you see people looking after it, then you're going to up your game and you're going to be influenced by that and you're going to do better. But if you're in an area where it's been absolutely neglected, then you're going to kind of follow suit, and why would you look after it if nobody else is? So I think that's, that the physical improvements in the area improve behaviours and improve perceptions, both internally and externally, and that has to have a good impact on your well-being. It just feels nice to walk through Dalmarnock. It feels nice. You know, it's well lit. You can go to the train station now. I don't know if you're familiar with Dalmarnock train station, right? But it used to have a bridge that went across to the East End Sawmills, and it was dark and it was dank, and you had to go down a steep set of stairs, no accessibility, maybe with a pram, you know, or coming home late at night. It felt dangerous. It was quite scary. There were no homes round about. They had all been demolished. So you had quite scary streets to get through before you got home. That has real negative impacts on your well-being on a day-to-day basis. And if you're having to walk past derelict buildings, then that's just adding to that. And, you know, badly lit streets, all of that. So to me, it's obvious. You walked into Dalmarnock now, you come at the train station, you're walking into a vibrant community now. And as Lidl opens up, that'll light up even more and hopefully attract more people to open businesses there. So, I think the impacts are huge.
Martin, that must be music to your ears. I mean, you've been at Clyde Gateway since 2009. You've been the development director. You're going to be chief executive. I think it seems that your people, place and transformation and jobs theme is working.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to hear, you know, the kind of advocates for the area and to hear the changes as well. And I think, you know, for somebody like myself that's been involved in the project since the outset, and I was kind of saying, you know, a couple of days ago, sometimes you can get a bit blind to what's happening, you know, because you're so engaged into the project, you're so engaged into the delivery of the project, and every now and again you meet somebody who's maybe not been here for 5 years or maybe longer, he'll come out and say, wow, I can't believe what you've achieved here, I can't believe the transformation. And so it's always good to kind of get that kind of positive reinforcement. At the same time, you really can't get complacent, you know, because if you allow any sort of momentum to build up in terms of decline, it can go pretty quickly. So, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about trying to get the small things right as well, and, you know, working on that. And I'll give an example of that. You know, over the last few weeks, we've been trying to get a bin moved in one of the streets that was causing a bit of a problem, you know. So we've got that shifted because you've got to kind of keep on top of it. So it is working, but there's much more to be done, you know, as well. You know, we need more jobs. You know, we need more people. We want all of that type of thing to happen, and, you know, we can kind of keep growing as well. What we've tried to do is, in terms of some of the master planning stuff, is, you know, what we talked about in terms of key routes and spaces, you know, create the places where people want to walk and create the connections. We built two bridges to kind of illustrate that point, to help open the area up, you know. And once you've kind of got those kind of foundations, you can then start to develop around it. And, you know, we're talking about housing, I'm not wholly fixated on what the housing blend should be, or what the tenure should be, or what the housing type should be. Quite, you know, it's a case of just making sure that we've got the right sites and the right locations for people to develop, and, you know, either the community will demand it or the market will lead it, and, you know, and we can create great places off the back of that.
Well, we're coming close to the end of the podcast now, the episode, but you were talking about trains and you were talking about Bridgeton, and my grandfather was a station master at Bridgeton Cross in the 1920s, I believe.
Yeah.
And my father used to look out the windows and watch big public meetings under the canopy at Bridgeton Cross during the general strike. The point is that he wouldn't recognise the place now because the canopy is not there. What's going on?
Yeah, well, the Bridgeton umbrella, I mean, it gets called lots of different things. It was one of the projects that we dealt with when we came in initially. We'd done a fantastic piece of work where we worked with Historic Environment Scotland, and we scraped back the layers of paint all the way through, right back to the original, and then we got the art school to recreate a digital copy of the umbrella. And it originally had been painted a pale blue and a light blue and a gold. And so we cleaned the umbrella and we painted it as part of the works that we did at Bridgeton Cross. But it wasn't enough in terms of being able to restore that that listed structure back to the standard that it was needed. And so we've always had the desire to, you know, to get it taken away, get it taken into factory conditions, really restore it as best we can, you know, and bring it back and reinstall it. And so that's the point that we're at now. So we've got acknowledged experts working on it. We've got a great technical team around it. So we have now carefully dismantled the structure, and that's been fascinating in terms of what it's thrown up as part of that. And it is now sitting in two local locations. One is part of the kind of shot blasting process that will effectively take it back to the original cast iron structure, and then it goes through a new paint process, and then once that's done, it will be brought back to site and then reassembled.
And why did you decide to go to such trouble over an old thing like that when you could have just built a kind of bus shelter?
Yes, I know, absolutely. Well, do you know, there's two things. One, it's an iconic part of Glasgow, and it's an iconic part of the Preston area. And actually, it was a Category A listed structure, so it's of national significance as well. And, you know, I'm a kind of modernist at heart, but, you know, I've got a real admiration for those types of structures and the historical fabric of our city. And, I've been at this one for a while, and there was no way I was going to let it decline. And I wanted to make sure it was done to the best possible standard. And it's been an emotive project as well, you know, in doing it. But, you know, when... Now that the site's set up and we've got all the artwork from the local schools around it, and we've got an artist engaged, and we've got a history programme running alongside it as well. And I think it's, you know, there's actually a nice part to the project as well, as people are actually starting to sort of, you know, remember the structure and remember the, you know, the contribution that it's made, you know. So, yeah.
Rosie, are you happy about this, Rosie?
At first, with the idea of removing it from site entirely rather than repairing it on site filled me with dread, because I thought the local response will be awful, people will not be happy. So, you know, the reasoning for it was explained to me, and I understand it now and I fully support it, but originally I was really, really nervous, and being a community member on Clyde Gateway Board, I thought I was going to get it in the neck everywhere I went, because it means an awful, awful lot to local people, and I don't think I even fully appreciated how much it meant until people reacted really to just that fear of it being removed, thinking we were just going to take it away and never bring it back. So I think now people understand it, and as Martin said, they're getting behind it, and they're excited to see it come back. If anything happens to it while it's in the factory, we will never ever live it down. We need to make sure it goes back. But I, you know, fully support it now.
Yeah, I'm really excited for, you know, when it comes back. I just know it's going to look amazing. You know,
so. It's going to be phenomenal, and it might possibly be there for another 100 years. Which, yeah, had it been left, you know, we'd have maybe seen another 10 or 20. So,
well, I'm really looking forward to coming and having a look, when it's all done. So,
yeah, I think if anybody was in any doubt of how important this was, seeing how animated Rosie was when Martin was talking about getting it renovated, that would prove it to everybody. That brings us to the end of the Scottish Housing News podcast. I'm Kieran Finlay. Thanks to my co-host Jimmy Bach, and thanks to the guests Martin Mackay and Rosie Robertson. We'll be back in a couple of weeks.